So tonight begins Pelegish Begiva, and this has been much anticipated. We've spent a few weeks pushing this off till we actually finally got to it, and now we begin. Pelegish Begiva is the setting sun of Shoftim. It is the end of Shoftim, but it is also the end of an era and a very dark era. So this is not going to be the most upbeat area of Tanakh, and that's why you probably haven't learned it beforehand. It's because people don't like to teach this. It's because it's a very dark era, but at the same time, it's necessary to be able to understand Shmuel Aleph and Melachim. In order to be able to get there, we need to understand where it came from and the depravity that we move from and into the light of Sefer Shmuel. That's why it's important as the last step. Most people don't get to this part. We're going to be covering Perek Yotes, Chof and Chof Aleph of Sefer Shmuel. Of Sefer Shoftim, very interesting area. What we're going to do is, as we usually have, is the booklets contain the text, so you have the full Perek Yotes, which I'm going to focus on just for the next little bit, and then there's space for notes if you need, and then we have a few sources at the end about considering what a Pelegish is, what we'll cover tonight. We'll do some sources if appropriate, and finally consider the parallel to Sodom. Those are the three sections we're going to do afterwards. We'll work through it slowly, but I think we'll try to think through it rather than just read it. We're going to try to think this out. And, of course, in the back there's a map, just so we can get a sense of where we're going and where we're coming. So, to begin, this is a story which is a microcosm. This story starts off as a personal family story, and it becomes a tribal national story. So, but it's important to appreciate the story in each of its levels, in each of its concentric circles. So let's start at the very beginning. Let's start with the story, and let's move our way outwards. So we told the story. Let's consider these first three psukim as their own drama before we get any further. Let's read them together and then consider. Vayhi bayamim ahem, it was in those days, umelech ein bi Yisrael, there was no king in Israel. Vayhi ish levi, Garbi Arkasehar Ephraim Vaikach Lo Isha Pilegesh Mibes Lechem Yehuda. And there was a man who lived in the hills of Har Ephraim, and he married a woman or a Pilegesh. And the way they translate this in the regular sources is concubine, which makes it much less understood than even in the Hebrew. Right? They send the kids home with this. They say, okay, you know, we meet Aram as a Pilegesh, and they say he had a concubine. So all the kids say he had a concubine. They understand less than if they just said the Hebrew. So he has a concubine. And he lives in Bethlehem. Fun. Vatizne alav pilagsho, and his concubine. Now this is a very hard word to translate here, and it is going to actually hinge upon what she is, what her relationship is. It seems that there was some infidelity, there was some disloyalty. Vatelech meitoy el beis avir, and she flees to her father's house. Right, she returns home el beis lechem Yehuda to Bethlehem. Vatihi sham yamim arba'a yechadashim, and she stays there for 4 months. Vayokom Isha, and her husband gets up. Vayelech Achareah, he goes to speak to her, to woe her. Ledaber Alibah, La Shiva, to bring her back. Vanaara Imoy, and his lad is with him. Vetzemet Chamorim, and he has a string of donkeys. Vativieu Beis Avia, and Vadiyireu Avia Naara, Vayismach Lekrosai, and the father sees him and is so happy to see him. Okay, so we have a regular Lahavdil soap opera. You know, we have the drama which is unfolding. There's a lot of things we can learn from here. A lot of things. First of all, let's just consider this at this point in time. Do we have names?
No.
No names. Isn't that interesting? Okay. So let's take it one step further. Let's look at the structure. We have an ish. What's the description we have for him?
Lady.
An ish lady, a Levite, who's coming from Beis Lechem Yehuda in the mountains of Ephraim. We have a man who's from Levi, who's walking in the mountains of Ephraim, and he is from Bethlehem. This sounds like another anonymous structure we've had just beforehand, and that is just the story beforehand, Pesel Micha, which we spent a few weeks on. In Pesel Micha, there was a shrine which was in the house in the mountains of Ephraim, and there was a priest who came from Beis Lechem Yehuda, and he was an Ish Levi. So interestingly enough, the moment we start the story, we're not told anything about it, but we are told something about it. We're told that somehow this story is the continuation or the shadow of the shrine of Micha. Very interesting. That's all we're told by not being told. Is that interesting? Now let's take it a little further. Consider some of the details. Okay, so he marries this woman. Now, what is the definition of an Isha? Isha means, this doesn't mean woman as in female. Isha in Tanakh means wife. And what is the definition of a wife? The definition of a wife is a person who is wed. There's a wedding. There's a wedlock between a man and a woman, which is, first of all, there's a process which starts that, a kiddushin, that starts marriage, and there's also something protecting that, and that's called a kesubah. We all love to put our beautifully adorned kesubahs on the walls, and it's a beautiful thing, and people have artists do them, which is wonderful. Actually, at basic rock bottom, at foundation, a kesubah is a legal document. What is the purpose of a kesubah? Not just to be read under the chuppah. What is the purpose of the ksubah? A contract in which way? What ramifications does it have? So who's it protecting?
The woman.
It's primarily protecting the woman, because what's going to happen is that if there's going to be divorce or death, that doesn't help the man, that's not preventative. But for divorce, what it means to say is that should he decide to divorce, then he's going to have to pay a lot of money. Which means to say that before he goes off in a rage, before anything happens in his mind, he's going to think very carefully. So what happens is that it's a check and balance in terms of the marriage, which is an interesting point. Now, this is from the perspective of Tanakh, and certainly there's a lot to discuss in terms of contemporary times. But at this point in time, that is the definition of what Tanakh says is an isha. But what is the pilegesh? A pilegesh is a different definition. Pilegesh means something else in Torah terms. Not clear what that is. So, what was that? No. So
it's a second wife.
Okay. So it might be some form of marriage, but then it's different because it's not the same form of union as a marriage. So what type of union is it then?
So
okay. So let's take a look. The first time a pilegesh is mentioned in the Torah is whom? Who is the first pilegesh of the Torah? Okay, great. So the first time we meet a Pilegesh is, we don't know if it is Hagar, but we certainly meet her. If you wouldn't mind just turning to the source section. This is on page 4, source section. What is a Pilegesh? The first time that we officially meet a Pilegesh is in Bereishis, Chof Hay. It says, V'livnei pilagshim asher la'Avraham nasan Avraham atanos. Avraham has a pilagshim, right, concubines, and he sends them off. Well, I mean, he sends off their children to the east, right, with gifts. He sends them off to the eastern lands. It's interesting historically who these people were and what gifts these were. I've heard some people say that some of the ancient Chinese traditions, some of them may have been as a function of these gifts. Be it as it may, anthropologically, very hard to know. But Avraham has these other children who are not Yitzhak, they're not Yishmael, they're from a later wife, and he sends them off. So Rashi comments on, so what is this Pilegesh? Who is this person or these people? Rashi says the following, source 2. HaPilagshim, Chasar Ksiv, it is written Chasar, meaning, when you look at this in the Torah script, there is actually a Yud missing. And when it says so Pilagshim, it actually could read Pilagsham, not in plural, Pilagsham. What does that mean? He says, Shelah ha'isa ela pilegesh achas. There was only one pilegesh. And who was that? As most of you said, he Hagar, he Keturah. Keturah, who he remarried, and all these children we know that he had from her, was in fact Hagar, who he remarried after she was sent off. Okay, that's what Rashi says. Now Rashi gives us the important definition. Nashim biksuva, when it says an isha, it means to say that is a union, which is through marriage and with a document of a security. Pilagshim b'lo iksuba. A pilegesh is a marriage, but it lacks the security. And as it talks about in Sanhedrin, that David HaMelech had pilagshim. So what difference does it make? The relationship is still a wedlock. It is still marriage, but it's marriage without the same degree of security. It's the same. The relationship doesn't have the same gravity. That's what Rashi understands over here. It's certainly in the former practice. But this is not the end of the understanding, because in fact, this is something perhaps a little shocking to our sensitivities, but the Ramban says it's something altogether different. It's worse than that. The Ramban says in source 3, the Rashi kasav nashim b'ksuba pilagshim b'lo iksuba. Rashi says that nashim are with a ksuba and pilagshim don't have a ksuba. Kedama nashim b'lo pilagshim to David b'Sanhedrin, quoting Rashi. V'ein hatavar kain. Says the Ramban, that's not in fact the truth. That's not how, what a Pilegesh is. Kiloy tikra Pilegesh, elo kishihi belay kiddushin. A woman is a Pilegesh if there is no wedding. Not only is she lacking, not only is this union lacking any form of security for the relationship, but it lacks even wedding. It even lacks the initial consecration. Right, and he says, and his proof is ki aksuba midibrei sofrim, because the Ramban understands that aksuba is only rabbinic, so the Torah couldn't be relating to a operation or a type of union which depended on aksuba, which wasn't in effect yet. Says the Ramban, very very fascinating, and he changes the girsa in Sanhedrin. He says there's actually a different text in Sanhedrin that relates to the proof that Rashi brought. Now, what this means to say is that according to the Ramban, and this is really shocking, certainly to our sensitivities, is that there was a form of relationship which was outside of wedding. Right? Meaning to say that whoever these Pilagshim were, was the affair was outside of the constraints of marriage. Now to us and to our sensitivities, we're brought up, and certainly the sensitivities we have, is that relationships are within the context of marriage. Right? Now, what the Ramban is saying is that a Pileg is represented something outside of that sphere. That's what the Ramban says. This is important because when we need to think about what's going on in our story over here, it's really critically important to understand the relationship between this man and his significant other. Why? Why do we need to? Why is that important to us? Because
it explains the entire power dynamic between the two of them.
Okay, meaning the sense of trust, the sense of connection, the sense of responsibility they have for one another is going to depend on the form of relationship. So we need to understand what's going on between the two of them in the first place, right? There seems to be some form of dearness between the two of them, and we see that how? How do we see that there is a form of connection between the two of them?
Because they said one was unfaithful. So he was unfaithful.
Well, there seems to be an unfaithful part to it, but the fact that he goes back and he goes to get her again means to say that there is care in this relationship. So this is what we need to be thinking about globally. What was she to him and he to her? What was this relationship? That's why this is important. Let's take this one step further. How does this express itself historically? The Ramban and Rashi are very hard to verify. What was the actual, we'll call it, halachic parameters of at this stage, or perhaps even later on? The Ramban says a very, very fascinating comment. And he says the following. He takes it one step further, which is perhaps the most shocking of all. And that is the following. The Rambam says in Source 6, there's the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, in the Halachas of Kings. He says, a king has the right to marry women and pilagshim. Now, we're not going to get into polygamy right now, but just the notion of that he is able to marry an Isha and a Pilegesh. Nashim iksuba v'kidushin, or Pilegshim b'loi iksuba b'loi kidushin. The Rambam says that a Pilegesh is defined as a person who there is a relationship with without marriage or ksuba, like the Ramban. Elo b'yichud bilvad kone osa muteres lon. Aval ahedjot osur b'Pilegesh, elo ba'ama ivriya bilvad achar yiud. Says the Rambam a very important distinction, and that is that the only person who is actually allowed to have a relationship with a Pilegesh is, in fact, a king. This is important. Only a king is given such, whatever, we'll call it a waiver of responsibility to a relationship. But a regular individual has no right to such a relationship, says the Rambam. And in fact, if you were to take a look at Source 8, he says historically there's a bit of a problem, because what do we see? We see Avraham has a Pilagsh, Yaakov has two Pilagshim, right? Because Bila and Zilpah were not Nashim. There was Leah and Rachel, who were his wives, and then there was Bila and Zilpah, who were Pilagshim. So how does that work? He wasn't a king. The Rambam says a very fascinating thing historically. And this is what sets our moral bearing today. He says, Kodem in the Source 8, Kodem Matan Torah, Hoya Adam Pagea Isha Bashuk, if they say there was a meeting between a man and a woman, and they happen to meet, if there is a mutual agreement, they could have what we'll call a free relationship. There will be a union which wasn't bound by marriage or any other later considerations. V'zohi hanikres kedesha, and this is what the Torah calls. What's the word kedesha? The word the Torah calls is a prostitute, meaning to say that this is a relationship without any gravity, a relationship without any responsibility. The Torah, so this before Matan Torah, this is what would happen. Mishenitna Torah, Nesra Kadesha, the Torah comes along and explicitly says that relationships come with responsibility. That's why the Torah says, Shenemar, Lotiye Kadesha Mibnos Israel, that there should not be prostitutes among the daughters of Israel. And by the way, the end of that pasuk is, Veloyeye Kadesh Bibnos Israel, and a man shouldn't be equally. It's not one way or another. The Torah says there should not be frivolity in relationships. On both sides. Lefichach kol haboy lisha l'shem znus b'loy kiddushim loy kemin ha-torah b'bnei shebal kedesha. Then, therefore, if there is such a relationship, it actually incurs a makos lashes, which is the degree that the Rambam sees this. The Rambam, in fact, understands that the pilegesh relationship is such. The pilegesh relationship is the relationship without commitment, without marriage, without even a ksuba later on. Says the Rambam, but that changed. When the Torah entered the picture, after Sinai, after Matan Torah, the Torah demanded responsibility for relationships. People can't just walk in and out of relationships. So Torah says that there needs to be a structure called marriage for relationships to occur, with the exception of one individual in all of the nation, and that is the king. That's the way that the Torah sets up, and the Rambam sets up our sensitivities. Now the question about this is the following: is this doesn't work so well, right? Because what's happening over here? Here we have an individual who is living in the period of Shoftim, right? So he is after the Torah is given. Is he a king? He's not a king. He's not a king ostensibly. There's no king at this point. Now, in fact, the Torah, the Psukim tell us explicitly there is no king. So don't get into your mind that this might be a person with a different status, right? And what happens? But he has. There's a relationship called Epilegesh over here. So what's going on? What was that?
Isn't Shevet Levi a different status?
I don't know. This Rambam doesn't identify them, certainly for this. Right? The Rambam says that relationships come with Kiddushim, there needs to be marriage, and the Rambam says the only exception is the king, and now we're living in a post-Sinai era, and here we have a person, we have a relationship between two individuals, and she's called Epilegesh to him. So what's going on over here? If you're taking the line of the Rambam, which seems to be the general moral compass that we live with, so what is going on over here? What is going on between these two people? Very, very troubling to just understand what's going on at the beginning. Let's think about this for a moment. This is important as well because it depends also how heavy duty a disloyalty there was between the two of them. You know that. Let's come back to that in just a moment. The Radvaz, Rav David ben Zimra, who is one of the earliest commentators on the Rambam. The way you know the commentators are earlier, by the way, is when you open up a book and you see, let's say, for instance, like this is a Gemara. The earlier commentators is always in the inner track on the inside of the page. So Rashi predates Tosos. Tosos are his grandchildren. That's on the outside. When you open up a Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, the Radvaz is on the inner track. He's one of the earlier commentators on the Rambam. The Rav David ben Zimra. Living the 1400s, and he says the following. Listen to this remarkable statement. This is in source 7. He says, "V'chein halokeach mikol gvul Yisrael v'chulei." He quotes our Rambam, and he says, "Shom Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav Noshim Miksuba Kiddushim Unpilakshim Beloy Ksuba Ubeloy Kiddushim." Okay, he's quoting the Gemara, and I want to go to the end of the second line where there's an abbreviation. The second word from this end of the second line says the following: "Va'af al gav." The pilegesh begiva kore osalifamim isha lefisha yunagim ba minag ishus. In our section, we'll see that she's called both an isha and a pilegesh. At the same time, those are two contradictory terms. So it says not that they're noag ba ishus. Their type of relationship was of a more serious type. That's number one. So it was a quasi relationship. Okay, that's what the Radvaz says first. Then he goes on further, and he says, va'avo pishoyo hediot. But he was a regular individual, meaning not a king. So how could there be such a relationship? He says, at that time, people weren't taking this so seriously. What does that mean? They weren't taking this so seriously. At that time, they weren't being very makpid about this. This, ladies and gentlemen, this is biblical, right? This is not somebody coming along and saying, you know, this is the Torah saying it, right? The Torah says lo yaseh kadesha v'lo yaseh kodesh b'vnei Yisrael. Now that means to say that the Torah is mandating this, and the way the Rambam understands it is that's real law. So that what the rabbis is saying is an interesting commentary on the times. What is the hallmark of such a society? We're in a society, but when we start the story, the first pasuk tells us that there's depravity in society. The role of relationships is even at under attack. That's what the Radvaz says. When you open up the first pasuk of Pilegesh Begiva, we see we're living in a society which has issues. That should be a very important introduction to everything that's going on. We're going to have many questions. I assume that we'll have more questions than answers in this section, because it only goes from bad to worse and worse. But the starting point is to realize is that even at the beginning, there's hairline fractures. What's the society doing? To what degree do they view relationships? That's the starting point, says the Radvaz. And he says, you know what? You know how I know that this wasn't a serious relationship? This wasn't a marriage? This was just a, you know, they were living with one another? How do you know that? He says, he goes into the end, he says, she'im hayu ba kiddushin, the second last line in the middle, let's say they were married. If there was infidelity, and let's say real infidelity, there was adultery, they wouldn't be able to be allowed to be remarried. He couldn't come back and say, reconsummate that marriage. That doesn't work like that if there's adultery, halachically. So says the rabbis, it must have been that this was a more frivolous relationship, but they cared about each other. They did, they really did. And that's why he tries to make amends and to woe when he comes back to her father's house. But it is certainly a sign of the times as to what the era they were in. Now, I apologize for having to discuss all these details in this context, but I think it is important just to be able to understand properly, first of all, some of the questions that we're going to come across because of this, and number two, also, to understand really what the dynamic is between the two of them. If you want to take this one step further, it's a very sensitive issue, but just to understand this one step further. The Gemara says the following about this. And the Gemara says the following, and just to appreciate another element, another level of this relationship. This is the Gemara to be found in Source 4, the Gemara in Gittin, Vav Amud Beis. The Gemara tells us the following. What happened? Why did they separate? What was really going on over here? The Gemara says the following. Dichsiv, in Shoftim, Vatizne Olav Pilag Shoim. She was unfaithful to him. Rabbi Yosar Amar, Zavuv Matzolah, Rabbi Yonasan Amar, Nima Matzolah. So Rabbi Yosar said that he was concerned because of a fly or a hare. The Gemara doesn't explain what that means. Then, v'ashkechei Rebbe Yosar le'Eliyahu. Rebbe Yosar, later on, happened to be walking down the street and bumped into Eliyahu Hanavi. And he says, Omalei ma ko'ovid ha-kodesh baruch hu. The million-dollar question. What's God doing? Right? If you could know what Hashem was doing right now. So he said to Eliyahu Hanavi, what is God doing? So he responded, Omalei osik b'pilegesh begiva. Hashem is learning or going through the section of Pilegesh begiva. Okay. Wow. What is that? So what's happening? Umayko Amar. So what does God say? Now look, if you're having an argument with somebody and you don't know what's right and what's wrong, so you know what you should do? Is if you can find out what God says, you're pretty much likely to be right, right? So that's what every Rabbi Yosar is saying, is I'm presenting a machlokes over here. So what does God say about this machlokes? This is his time, or his transparency, transparent time. He can work it all out now. So Umayko Amar, what does God say? So turning the page, he says, Amalei, Ev Yosar Bini Kahu Amer. This is what he says. Yochanan Yonasan Bini Kahu Amer. So Hashem was going through the story, and Hashem says that Rabbi Yosar says the story went like this, and Rabbi Yonasan said it went like this. Meaning God was saying the same discussion in the Gemara. So this, by the way, this is a very fascinating thing to think about. So he says, "Amalei chasu shalom umiikos sveka kameshmaya." Is God in doubt? Does God not know what happened? God was there. God witnessed the whole incident. So how does he not know? Really, they're both true. Now, this is important. He says, the question is that actually both incidents occur, and the question is what was the thing that really set him off in a rage? What's the focus of his rage? And the Gemara goes on to describe that perhaps what we're talking about over here is either that something in the food was not to his liking, there was a fly which was found in the food, or an intimate detail of their marriage, which he felt was actually something which could put him in danger. Those are the two things in his mind. But the Gemara goes on to say at the very end that whatever the reason was, is that you should be very careful about the tone, and this goes for everybody, the tone that's created in a house. Meaning, if you're the kind of person, whichever side of the spectrum you are, who's going to automatically get angry about things, even small things, then sometimes it ends up in pelegish begivers, in what we're about to see. That's what the Gemara's comment is. So whether he was warranted or not, whatever the dispute was, the Gemara seems to say either it was maybe something which was a serious medical issue for him, or maybe something very trivial, like what the food looked like for him. Irrespective of that, his reaction wasn't warranted. That's what the Gemara's conclusion is. And so we're left with this ambiguity over here. We're left with the ambiguity that something happened between the two of them, but whether it was serious or not, the way he treated her caused her to run away. The way he shouted at her, the way that clean and pristine space between the two of them was tarnished to the degree that she ran away. And the Gemara comments that such friction in a relationship can lead to such things. That's the Gemara's comment on this. So when we look at the beginning and it says, "Vatizne alav pilag shoh," it sounds like she is the one. Now, what the Gemara is saying is, she may have done something, but then how did he react? Right? So the Gemara is asking, where's the other side to that? She could have been something serious, or could have been something much more trivial. But in the end of the day, how did he react to be able to, and that generated her running away?
The word, "Vatizne."
Correct.
So you cannot interpret it to something else.
So interestingly enough, I was actually reading we're going to come across this a little bit later, a response of Rav Moshe Feinstein on this particular topic, because it's very interesting later on when we get into the details. And he commented that it seems from the Gemara that both opinions are very clearly moving away from adultery. Meaning both the opinions in the Gemara say that either it was something that affected the food or the intimate relationship, but it wasn't something about somebody else in the relationship. And he feels that the Gemara is very carefully doing that. He feels that the Gemara is actually correct. Above all, the Mefarshim will disagree, actually, that in fact what happened over here was more of a friction in the relationship internally than somebody on the outside, which is interesting. That was just the point that Rav Moshe points out. So now we have, there's a break in the relationship, and there's a movement to come back. Interestingly enough, how do they make amends? Who takes the first step in this? It sounds like he does, right? He makes the step, which sounds positive. Sounds like this is a great guy. Whatever, he feels remorseful for whatever he said. But when he comes back, look at the word carefully in Tanakh. He comes is in Pasuk Gimel. What was the word he uses? What's the point of his trip? Lahashiva. How do you spell that? How do you spell that? What's the last letter in that word?
A vav,
or a hey. Do you see there's in the parentheses it's a hey. Now, that means there's a kriyuk siv, which means to say that in the Tanakh text itself, it appears one way, but we read it a different way. Now you think, a vav or hey, what difference does that make? It actually makes a difference. What is it referring to? Lashiva means to return him. Lashiva with a hey means to return her. And perhaps in that very kriyuk siv, in the way we say it and see it, is actually very much the key to the relationship, because the only way to be able to create common ground is if both parties are working to return. Do you see that? The kriyuk siv over here is explaining something very important in relationships. He may walk back to her to return her, but if she's not walking back to return him, or vice versa, nothing's going to happen. That's what the pasuk is saying over here in this movement to fix our relationship over here. Now, let's take this a little bit further quickly. And that is the following. We see something else over here. Who is the happy party about this?
Oh, the dad.
He's so happy to see him, his son-in-law. Why would he be happy? Okay, so number one is he's paying the upkeep in the meantime, the room and door board. But let's think a little, yeah, that could be the most basic. But let's take it a little further. What else could be at hand? Why would he be happy? He obviously likes this relationship. Why would he like this relationship?
The guy's rich.
Because there might be something we don't know about the status of this man, of the son-in-law. It seems like the dad-in-law is very happy about the reconsummation of their relationship. And we're going to see he seems to be happy at all costs in just a moment. Which means to say that there's obviously something about this man, this Ish Levi, who we don't know his name and will never know his name, that is has this status in society, which is important because, first of all, it tells us a little bit about the relationship. And it's also going to tell us about who the good people in society are and what good people in society do or don't do at this time. That's important. We see this just from the fact that the father is happy. There's something else going on over here. So he comes out to meet him. Notice, has there been an interaction between the husband and the wife? Not that we're aware of, right? It's almost like a deal, right? He's coming back and he's meeting the father-in-law. That's what's happening, right? So where's she? Silent voice here. Very interesting. Let's take this one or two steps further, and then we'll call it an evening. So in Pasuk Dalet, Vayechazek boy chosnoi, and his father-in-law, Ava Avianara, takes hold of him, Vayeshev itoy shloshes yamim, Vayochlu vayishtu vayolinusham, and they eat and they drink and they have a wonderful feast for 3 days. This is obviously a circumstance of pomp and happiness. Wonderful. Vayhi Bayom Arvi, it's on the fourth day. Vayashkimu baboker vayokom lo leches vayomer Avianara el chazlonoi sa'ad libcho pas lechem v'achar talechu. He says, why are you leaving in the middle of the day? Have a nice meal. We'll have a brunch. I'll go get bagels at the corner store. We'll have tuna. It'll be wonderful. Let's just stay a little bit. Vayeshu vayochlu shteihem yachtav, and they both stood and continued to eat. And to drink. Vayomer avyanara el ish hoel no velin vayitzev libecho. It's already you're sitting, you're drinking. Why do you need to go? It's day four. Just stay around. Vayokom ish lo leches vayivtzar boy chosno vayoshov vayolin shom. And his father-in-law says, no, really. And he emphasizes and he puts pressure on him. Vayivtzar is a word we heard in Tanakh before, by the way. And he stays. Where else do we have the word vayivtzar? That somebody's pressurizing another individual to do something. Very early on in Tanakh. This is a happening. I'm trying to remember if it's mentioned that's even earlier. I know that there is a mention that there might be that. I don't remember. Where else is this mentioned? Early on in Tanakh. This is going to be a big highway of a bridge. Once we open this up. By Sarah and Avram, actually, it's interesting enough that in that relationship over there, by Sarah and Avram and Hagar, that whole triangle, actually you see that there's a silent relationship that she actually gives Hagar to, but she doesn't force him. She's very proactive in that relationship, but she doesn't actually force her upon him. But it happens in the story at the beginning of Parashas Vayera, where Lot is living in the city of Sodom. And what happens?
Two angels
come. They want to stay in his house. And what happens is that the people of the city surround the house by Yiftzar, and they try very hard to break the door. That's where the word is used elsewhere in Tanakh. And you think to yourself, well, that's a little sinister. Right? I mean, over here, it's a nice father-in-law who's trying to make his son-in-law stay, and everybody's happy and everybody's smiling, and the relationship's back together, and we're at a great place, and the sun is shining. But then we should remember that this is going to be the first of many parallels to that section in the Torah. There's a very sinister backdrop over here, which has been drawn already. So he says, please stay. Let's close with this pasuk. He got in the Vayom HaChamishi Loleches, Vayom HaVyanara Sadnon Levavchav Yismahamu Ad Natos Hayom Vayochlu Shteim. And the fifth day, they carried on eating, and actually let's just close with this. He said, on the fifth day, this is enough. He gets up to go. It's getting dark. Enjoy the food. Get up the next morning. It's not good to travel late in the afternoon. And he says, please, please stay. And the man is going to ignore this. And these words are going to be the words that haunt them the rest of their lives, is don't travel later on in the day. It's too dangerous to travel at the end of the day. And this is going to be now, this is the premonition of what is about to come. So what we've covered today is, what we try to understand was just trying to just look into that micro relationship and the very little bit we've told about it to understand what's going on between the two of them. What's their relationship, and what's the relationship between the third person in this party up to this point, which is the father-in-law? And what does that say about our people? What does it say about all of them? Why is she silent? Seems like he's very happy. And then we started this story of the interaction between the father-in-law and the son-in-law. What we're going to do next week is we're going to complete the perek, hopefully. And then we're going to take a step backwards and then appreciate all the Tanakh parallels to it and get a better sense of what really is going on over here. So God willing, next week, Wednesday, all going well with